All right, we are in Acts chapter... good grief, I am sorry. It is 2 days in a row that I'm stuck on the word Acts. And what's funny is usually it's Revelation. I don't know what Mark's problem is. We're in Mark chapter 8, verse 11. Let's talk about and digest what we've talked about over the last chapter and a half. Because it's a lot of big stuff that's happening right here in the middle of Mark. What's happened? Clean versus unclean, a major issue that was happening. And what was that? That was a clash between Jesus and... he had the law, but in particular, what people? The Jerusalem Pharisees and other Pharisees from the region, yes. So you have them coming, the big guns coming in to fight with Jesus, in particular over this clean, unclean issue. Which Jesus not just takes the bait, but then he actually makes problems even worse for himself by saying, actually, let's just eradicate all this clean, unclean issues altogether. Which kind of makes them upset and really confuses the disciples, right? What else happens? Say it again. Then we move into the feeding of the 4,000, which is right after what event? The healing of the deaf mute, which is right after what event? The Syrophoenician woman. And we talked about yesterday how all of these events are interrelated. And the reason why we know that is even because of the way in which Mark has been connecting the different events through linguistic elements, conceptual elements, theological elements, etc. They're all connected. We're still talking about the same issue. And even today, once we get into the text, you'll realize that really the bread issue, the clean, unclean issue is still on the table. We're still talking about it. Why? Why are we still talking about it?
Just for their way of life, and they thought that that was the right thing to do their whole life, and now somebody's telling them that it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a major issue. It's not a big issue for us. Because this is just old hat. Of course, I don't have to worry about clean and unclean. You know, the vegetarians now are the weird ones, or the vegans, but you know, everybody else is fine. That was the opposite back then. People that actually took care of what they ate, the dietary laws for the Jews, that's what gave them their identity. It was so much a part of their identity because it came straight from Moses that to eradicate it is to do something that is simply beyond the power of a mere man. This is a big issue. And we'll find out this is a big issue even after Jesus dies, goes to heaven. We've even seen that the disciples still had a problem with it. It's pretty ironic right now that I'm going through. I just finished Acts 10 and 11, and we're going right now through Mark chapter 7 through 8 because they're parallel. I feel like I'm talking about the same thing over and over, hour to hour. But it's what's hammering into my head is this is a major issue. Right in the middle of the book of Acts, lobbed right in the middle, one of the major ways in which the church almost splinters is over these issues. And that's even the way God tries to recommunicate it back to Peter. He puts down the sheet and says, kill and eat. And Peter argues, no, not going to happen, 3 times. And then in chapter 11, whenever Peter, after Cornelius has already been converted and his whole household and everything of that nature, you have these circumcised believers, is what the text says in chapter 11 of Acts, coming and really ticked off of what Peter's done. They're saying, how could you possibly do this? You know what they actually say to him? They say, how could you have possibly gone into the house of a Gentile and eaten with him? That's their objection. Their objection is not, how come you allowed them to convert? Their objection is, how come you're breaking some of the key laws that makes us distinct? Don't get me wrong, we'll get to the issue of you letting them in. That is an issue. But you're even breaking some of these other laws that they're just basic laws. How could you have humanized the Gentiles by eating with them? And Peter's response is, I now understand. He literally says, I now realize, when he's talking to Cornelius, I now realize that God doesn't take people at face value. But instead, he judges them by their heart, who they are. And Peter says, now I understand. And we're in the middle of Acts. I'm going, Peter, weren't you here in Mark chapter 7 through 8? He's like, yeah, I was. I was the source behind this material, remember? He's like, it just was hard for me to get. I had a really hard time getting this. And even after Acts chapter 11, one of the most amazing things that happens in Acts chapter 11 is the bigots really get upset at Peter, and Peter looks at him and he says, God poured out His Holy Spirit on the Gentiles the same way He poured it out on us. What was I supposed to do? Tell God no? The way that even validated us with the tongues and the Spirit coming on us at Pentecost, it's validating them. What do you want me to do? We got to believe. And it says, and they believed. They didn't need to hear anything more. Instead, they started praising God. And I thought about the question, how many times does that happen when you're talking to a bigot? And you talk to them about the image of God that's in the other person, and they're just like, you're right, praise God. But what we also find, and even in the church, the issue still wasn't laid to rest after chapter 11, was it? Because what happens four chapters later? Acts, you guys have all taken Acts, right? What happens in Acts 15? What's the Jerusalem Council all about? This issue. Okay, fine. We'll tolerate the Gentiles coming in, but they at least have to be circumcised. They at least have to become a Jew before they can become one of us. Because otherwise, we're just throwing out everything. And what's the decision of the Jerusalem Council? No, they don't have to be circumcised. Because that's not what God's judging on anymore. This issue is something that actually, in Paul's ministry, he even shows, even after Acts 15, a lot of his persecution, a lot of the discomfort with Paul, is because of this issue. He's treating the enemies as if they're one of us. So I think the reason why Mark takes such a long time discussing this issue, and the reason why I'm okay with taking a long time discussing this issue, because you have to understand the significance of what's actually happening here. The entire ship of God's people and what defines them is turning around midstream. This is a major deal. And it's something that if you don't understand how much clean and unclean meant to them, you won't understand why Jesus eventually gets killed. He's doing things you're not allowed to do. Especially if you claim to be the pristine and, you know, squeaky clean Messiah. Man, this guy looks dirty. Are you guys following me so far? The significance of this. Okay. What else happened? Feeding of the 4,000. He even shows what? We were doing geographical theology yesterday. What was that showing? Feeding the 5,000. Why is that significant? Say it again. Yeah. Yeah, it's the difference of territory from Jewish to Gentile. And the same miracles are happening. Is she okay back there? You all right? Okay, just making sure. I didn't know. Am I talking too loud? Is that what? Okay. I thought there was somebody doing this. I was like, oh no. Are they going to be throwing up dust and running down the aisles and screaming at me? That's Acts 7. Okay. All right. The frustration, the boiling point of this issue starts to come to a head here in this passage that we're going to be reading today. Verses 11 and following, you see the Pharisees getting really frustrated. You see Jesus starting to get really frustrated, especially with His own disciples. So let's dive in. Mark chapter 8. I'm just going to just, if I say Acts, just don't even correct me. Mark, I almost said it again. Mark chapter 8, verse 11. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. The word question is actually the word that means to dispute or to debate. They're basically coming, they're saying, okay, we got to shut this guy up. This is out of control. To sit there and to be saying that our clean, unclean rituals really don't matter anymore, really ticks me off. But then to start saying that the Gentiles are a part of the people of God too, even though they're the ones that God did the clean, unclean issues to keep us away from to begin with, that they're good too, okay, we got to go at this guy because this cannot be the Messiah. Why else would they have gone at Jesus? Say it again. How so? That's exactly right, but how so? It does, yeah, the crowds. The crowds was an issue. Matter of fact, Mark chapter 7, verse 17, at the end of the unclean, clean issue, what does Jesus do? He brings the crowds together and then publicly shames the Pharisees right in front of everyone. You think they've forgotten that? In order for them to gain their honor back, they had to deal with the one that shamed him to begin with. And you could either do it directly or indirectly. And they'll try multiple tactics throughout the rest of the gospel. Eventually, they just say, you know what, the only way we can deal with this guy is if we kill him. And kill him in the most shameful way possible, so that everything he did shameful to us, all the honor he took from us, will come back. Because who's really going to believe or line up with a guy that was hanging on a tree? Deuteronomy 21 says that person's cursed by God. That's the guy that you're going to follow? That's the guy who accumulated our honor? No. That guy has no honor, otherwise he wouldn't be hanging there. Ultimately, they're trying to figure out a way to get... See, because what we have to understand is that honor in the ancient world was a limited commodity. Just like other resources of our day. It was limited. And as a result, honor was something people would fight over. Because if someone is gaining honor, that means someone else is losing it. Because there's only so much honor to go around. Even though it is in an abstract reality, honor, it doesn't mean there's an unlimited amount of it as a resource. It is limited. Therefore, if you lose honor, you have to gain it back. And the only way you can do that is if you attack the one that's coming that had come right at you. There's also something, a theological reason why I think the Pharisees are coming at Jesus, and it's quite ironic. Pharisees, compared to the Sadducees, were considered what? Theologically speaking. Theologically liberal. The Pharisees were theologically liberal. Sadducees would have been more the theologically conservative. But the irony of the liberalness of the Pharisees' theology was that their theological liberalness was intended to keep more people out. It wasn't to bring more people in to the community. They put up different hedges in order to make sure that the heart of God was totally protected. Matter of fact, that you weren't even near anywhere close to breaking what was at the heart of God. The point was to make sure it was harder to get in and be in a part of this community. That was what their liberalness was accomplishing, which is why it ultimately leads to them being politically conservative. Because their theological liberalness, you guys following me on this? Their theological liberalness was actually keeping more of those people out. Therefore, they would be more conservative. But the theological conservativeness of the Sadducees was actually intended to bring more people in. Because then they could hang out with all of the politicians and get their agendas pushed by people with the sword. So they're coming at Jesus also because they're saying, you're opening the floodgates. It almost sounds like you're a Sadducee saying that these dirty Gentiles are okay. And ultimately, the Pharisees and the Sadducees weren't complete enemies, but they were never complete friends, and don't think that they were. I don't know if they're as far apart as Democrats and Republicans are today, but that's close. Part of the same government, you have to be friends on some level, but you have to just kind of tolerate that friendship. Because I promise you, the Pharisees were not okay with their key power not being the temple. Because ultimately, the person that gave the Sadducees the temple was a dirty Gentile anyway. Well, kind of. The Hasmoneans, but they were violators of the law and therefore need to be dealt with anyway. All right. So they have multiple reasons of why they're coming at Jesus, but ultimately what the word even insinuates is they weren't coming just to ask him your question. They're coming, they're starting a fight. The Pharisees came and began to debate Jesus, to dispute Jesus, to test him. They asked him for a sign from heaven. The word test has actually been used once already in the Gospel of Mark and will be used two more times. The word for test is used for the very first time in Mark chapter 1, verse 13. What is in that section? In what chapters? In what chapters? It'll be on the test in a couple of weeks. The temptations. Exactly. The temptation of Satan. Jesus went into the desert, was forced into the desert by the Spirit, and for 40 days he was tested or tempted by Satan. The next time it's used is in Mark chapter 8, verse 11, which is right here. The third time it is used, though, is in Mark chapter 10, verse 2, and that says, some Pharisees came and tested Jesus by asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? What are they trying to do there? Yeah, exactly, to use Moses as a weapon against Jesus. Because really, Jesus started the fight to begin with whenever he said clean and unclean. No longer we need to mess with. He started the fight first. So they're going to try to finish it with some other laws. Mark chapter 12, verse 15 is the last time that this word is used in Mark's gospel. It says, should we pay or shouldn't we? But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me, test me? He asked, bring me a denarius and let me look at it. What's the issue there? Do we pay Caesar taxes or not? What are they trying to do now? Trip him up in a different way. Not with the Mosaic Law, because he's destroyed them with that several times already. They're like, you know what we can do is we can just get him, we can get him on the wrong side of Caesar, and that'll take care of him. Every time the word test, though, what you need to do is to be reading it through the lens of the very first time it's used. With Satan. Every time it's used, Mark's bringing up an issue. He's saying, you think Satan stopped tempting him? You think Satan's letting him go? Now just let it, you know what? He beat me in the desert. I'll just hang back and let the Son of Man just do what he does. Now Satan's looking for a way to discredit and to destroy Jesus. And ultimately, my son right now, he is, my youngest son, Maddox, he is just baffled by the cross right now. And he loves it. He's actually quite graphic when he talks about it. I mean, he's like, so why did Satan kill Jesus again? Why did he think he was going to win when he did that? I said, well, buddy, he just wants to kill. He just wants to destroy. So he was just trying to destroy Jesus. And he thought whenever he destroyed him that he had won. And I said, but then what happened? He's like, he rose from the grave. I was like, that's right. I was like, so actually he didn't win, but Satan thought he did. He goes, he rose from the grave and grabbed Jesus, or grabbed the devil by the head and started punching him in the eye. And I was like, something like that. It's pretty close, you know, pretty close. Satan's always lurking. And as a matter of fact, what's ironic in Mark's gospel is even at the resurrection in chapter 16, it almost looks like Satan wins. And we'll get there. But bottom line is this. Every time you see the word tempted or tested, you got to notice that Satan is lurking. I love the Passion of the Christ. It starts in Gethsemane. And Satan is there. I think that is exactly theologically accurate. Because every time, it's also what the issue is of the temptation, whether we're talking in the wilderness or Gethsemane or even in each of these issues, the issue is always identity. Every time. Satan's temptations are trying to get Jesus to be a different Messiah. And in Gethsemane, that's the same issue that's at hand. He's trying to get him to be a different Messiah. Satan lurking? You're darn right he's lurking. He's whispering things in either the people's ears or Jesus' ear, always trying to derail who Jesus came to be. And whenever the cross happened, I do think Satan thought he won. But ultimately the resurrection, that must have been an uncomfortable moment. But we'll talk about that in 8 weeks, 7 weeks. We're in the 8th week. We're almost done with the 8th week of school. We're over halfway done with this semester. Isn't that crazy? I just realized that this morning. And you have an inductive study due on Tuesday. I hope it's going well. All right. Where are we at? Oh, first verse. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. What were they asking him for? Yeah, first of all, what is the function of signs? The function of signs is not to do a magic trick. That's not what they're saying. They're not saying, hey, David Copperfield, let's see something better. No. They're going, no, we want a sign because you can't make the statements you've been making and not give validation to us from God. And no, feeding 4,000 to Gentiles doesn't count because Satan would do that to his own people too. That doesn't count. You need to give us a sign because you haven't given us one that really has any sort of merit since you told us about the clean, unclean issue. Because no, healing a Syrophoenician woman doesn't count. Healing a deaf mute inside of the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon doesn't count. Because those are the realms of Satan. Therefore, all you're really doing is proving to us the Beelzebub thing we were bringing up in chapter 3. We need a sign to validate what it is that you're saying. Because if your deeds don't match your words, well then we won't. Well, then we know you're an imposter. Is this making sense? Specifically, I think that possibly because they specify from heaven, it could mean that it could be just a euphemism from God. It could mean that. A way of just a circumlocution of just saying from God, but they don't want to say the name God. That might have been what they're saying. Or they could be asking for manna. Hey, you just gave these dirty Gentiles manna. We've heard rumors that you did the same thing to the Jews in our region. But I want to see it. I want to see it right now. We're the elite Pharisees. You give us some manna right now if you're the new Moses. The new Moses. You do know Moses killed the Gentiles, right? Oh, okay. But you're now providing for them? Show us a sign from heaven. Prove it to me. I love Jesus' response. He sighed deeply. What does that remind you of? did the healing of the deaf mute. Remember I told you the healing of the deaf mute, I believe Mark put it in the place he put it for literary reasons. I believe he was showing the spiritual deafness of his own disciples as well as the Pharisees. It's the exact same word for sigh deeply that we found in that text. He sighs deeply and it's connecting, it's going, these people are deaf and dumb. They are the mutes, spiritually. They just don't get it. He sighs deeply and he says, why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? But why? Why are you guys asking me this? I tell you the truth. No sign will be given to you. I'm sorry, what? No sign will be given to you. So you're not going to validate your words? Are you saying I haven't validated my words thus far? Have you seen the first 6 chapters of my ministry? Where have you been? Because it's not like I've been doing this in secret, although I have tried to keep it secret. But it's been out there. You've seen it. Even in your own synagogues, you've seen me heal people. And you need another sign. Are you just not hearing or are you just not seeing? What's the issue? I'm not understanding where the disconnect is here. But no, I'm not going to give it to you. And in an honor-shame situation, in an honor-shame war, when a challenge is given, give us a sign. What has to be evaluated at this point is whether or not the people that you're talking with are even worthy of entering into the challenge. But a no response is a response in an honor-shame war. In a no response can mean one of two things. Number one, it can mean that you don't have the ability to respond to your challenger. It can mean that. Or number two, it can mean you're not even worthy for me to respond to. And the crowd, ultimately the last stage, is the crowd has to decide if there is no response, which one was it? Was the person just incompetent? Or were those people not even worthy to be challenging at all? Because challenges can only happen between equals. It can only happen between equals. And if someone unequal is challenging somebody that's big, the person that is most honorable would not stoop down in order to even deal with it. So they just won't answer. And there is somewhat of a, I'm pushing away the honor shame game for a minute, but just to give you a little word of wisdom. There is some wisdom in that. Man, do not believe the lie that every time somebody does something to you in ministry, you have to respond. And it's not because they're lower than you. It's because sometimes some people just don't merit a response. I know that sounds harsh and that sounds mean, but it's not. You've got to understand, if you respond to every single negative thing that comes your way, that'll be your whole ministry. Because it comes from every angle. I'll be honest with you. I was a worship minister for 4 years. And I feel bad for worship ministers. I pray for them every day. My worship minister, I do whatever I can to fight for him. And the reason why is because worship ministers consistently have an X on their back. More than anybody. If you know, I didn't like how fast or slow that song was. I didn't like that style. Can you play this song? I don't like that song. Can you? And if you constantly are trying to, every set, if you're trying to please everybody, ultimately you'll realize you can please no one. So eventually I just said, okay, thanks. And that was my response. Okay, thanks. Okay, thanks. You're not changing anything. Yeah, I know. But thanks. Thanks for the input. Why aren't you changing anything? Because I can't please anyone. I'm not just going to ignore everybody. I'm going to try to match what I think the overall group is hitting. But most of the time, the complaints you hear from are the loudest people. They're not usually the majority. They're the loud minority. If you ever have somebody in ministry, like an elder or anybody, come up to you and say, there's a lot of people that say, you say, I need names or I'm not going to listen to you. And the reason why is because a lot of times the person that's coming up to you is actually the one that has the problem, and they're just blaming it on everybody else. Oh, there's a lot of people that are very upset with the way you preached, and oh, okay, well, who are they so I can go meet with them and have lunch? Oh, I promised I wouldn't tell names. Well, I also promised that I would never address an issue if I didn't have names to address it. Because in the same way that I have a faceless accuser, I'm responding to someone faceless as well. And I'd rather just do it face to face so that we both know each other. And honestly, so they can hear my heart and I can hear theirs. And maybe we can come to a middle ground. But if I have no one really to talk to, then this conversation really is just not helpful for me or you. Or all of those people. Does that make sense? Sometimes the best thing for you to do is just not to react. You'll get called names. You'll get people accusing you of stuff that's ridiculous. and just act the way Jesus does. Respond to sometimes. Sometimes it's important. Most of the time it's not. Most of the time you're more worried about your reputation than you are about the health of the church. Sometimes the best thing for the church is for you not to respond, even though it may hurt your reputation. You got to really question what you're fighting for in ministry. Because some people are more worried about fighting for their own jobs than fighting for their own reputation, even in academia. Even in Ozark. A lot of times people are more worried about fighting for themselves, for their own pride and reputation, than they are about fighting for the people around them. And that's just anti-gospel. You hear my heart in that? If you're fighting for yourself more than the other people around you, you don't know Jesus very well. And you need to get to know Him. Otherwise, you're going to do a lot of damage to a lot of people. Because you're going to be so worried about yourself that you're not really going to see them. Does that make sense? You hear my heart in that? Yes.
What about if it's your family being attacked?
Yeah, even in that, you got to figure out a way to deal with that. Especially, and this is not a slight, this is just reality. Women fights can be the most harsh. Oh my goodness. When women start using words, they may not use fists very well, but buddy, they can destroy people with words. And one of the things I've constantly encouraged my wife is just don't get involved in that. That's not your ministry. It's not your ministry. Just because Jesus was a male doesn't mean females get to act differently. And it is usually the law of second offense is always the most difficult one. Whenever somebody does something to me, a lot of times it didn't bother me, but who it really ticked off was my wife. You don't mess with my husband. And the same thing happens with me. Somebody says something about my wife, boy, I just want to grab them and just rip them apart. But if they said something about me, I'm just like, whatever. You got to guard against that. And it's not just to let them get slandered and, you know, sloshed through the mud. And that's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that the way in which you react is what people always remember. It's always what people remember. People a lot of times don't even remember the accusations. But it's the way you react that they remember. And if you react by acting like a jerk to the people, they won't even remember what they said. They'll just remember the way you reacted. But if you react by looking at them and going, "You really? That's what you think of my wife? Man, I'm sorry you don't know her very well. I'm really sorry. I feel bad for you. Maybe you and my wife should get a coffee. Because she really is an incredible woman." You react like that, and all of a sudden, everybody. Only thing that people remember is like, "What's wrong with that guy?" You see what I mean? The way that you always deal with conflict is by loving the person. And the way that they treat don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, there have been times whenever my biggest strength is my biggest weakness, and that's my mouth. And there have been times whenever somebody says something about my wife, and I basically was just like, "You better shut your mouth right now." And that's not an acceptable response. That is inappropriate for me to have said, and I was wrong. Even though what I was defending was right. It's what I tell my kids all the time. You can be saying the right thing, but if you say it the wrong way or at the wrong time, or if you're the wrong person to say it, then it doesn't matter if you were right or wrong. You're wrong. That's just the bottom line. Sometimes people think it's like their God-given gift to just rebuke everyone. No. Even if what you're saying is right, if you do it the wrong way or if you're not the right person, you need to shut your mouth. It's just not your job. Now, sometimes we have communities in which everybody doesn't want it to be their job because they don't want to rebuke anyone. And that's just as inappropriate. No. If somebody that you are close to in community with, like that you have earned a right to be heard in their life, is doing something that is hurting themselves or other people and you don't say anything, it's just as much on your head as it is on theirs. That's what I believe Matthew chapter 7 is talking about. The do not judge, the take the plank out of your eye. Why? So that then you can take the speck of sawdust out of your brother's eye. Because even a speck of sawdust can make you go blind. Right? Yeah, so whenever somebody's talking about your family or people that mean a lot to you, it's a lot harder to react in an appropriate way. Nevertheless, it's still the way you're supposed to react. It's the way Jesus did. Does that make sense? Do you hear my heart in that? Boy, you'll be tested on that issue, I can promise you that. I'm sure you have even in the dorms already. Yes? Do I need testimonies? Are we good? Okay. All right. Well, let's keep moving. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus to test him. They asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply, pointing back there, and says, "Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. I mean, what, if you're the Pharisees, you got to be just sitting there going, "What just happened here?" Like, seriously, we asked for a sign. He said, "I don't think so." Got back in the boat and left, and you're standing on the banks going, "Okay, clean and unclean." You know, I mean, like, what do you do? You've been shamed again by him not responding. He's saying you're not even worthy to respond to. Verse 14, the disciples had forgotten to bring bread. That's hilarious, because what's the scene right before this? The feeding of the 4,000. And they pick up 7 basketfuls afterwards. And they're like, "Oh, I forgot to bring bread." Well, okay. Disciples have forgotten to bring bread except one loaf. Surely they would think we're good. There's 13 of them in the boat. They have one loaf. He had 5 or 7 just a minute ago, and he fed 4,000. If they have one, surely we're okay. And yet they don't get it. Except for one loaf, they had with them in the boat. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Man, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." Notice the word he used, yeast. What is yeast a key ingredient for? Bread. We're still on the issue of clean and unclean. It's not stopped yet. And what is it if you Matthew chapter 13 brings up yeast in a different context. In Matthew chapter 13, it talks about the kingdom of heaven is like yeast, that when a woman kneads it into the dough, it spreads all the way throughout. It's pervasive. It just, once it gets into something, it just expands. He says, and that's how the kingdom of heaven is like. But in here, he uses it in a different way. He says, you got to be careful of the yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod. And what is the damaging thing that is pervasive in the Pharisees and in Herod's perspective that Jesus warned his disciples against? Think. What is it? What is it? That is definitely one of them, that they're fighting for themselves more than they are fighting for other people. So maybe the ethics is what Jesus is worried about, that the way that they are ethically moving is not the way that you need to be ethically moving. Possibly. What else? Where's the last time we saw Herod? Chapter 6. And what was happening? But what was that issue all about? Honor, shame, bigger than that. Jesus' identity. Wasn't it? For whenever Herod hears of all the things that are happening, what is his initial reaction? "This is John the Baptist, come back to judge me." He misidentifies Jesus, doesn't he? And what's the Pharisees' issue? They don't know who he is. You see the issue? He's saying, if you knew who I was, this clean, unclean issue would not be that big of an issue. Because if I am God, if I am the Son of Man, if I am the Messiah, then if I change the laws, you move with me. But the reason why they need a sign after sign after sign after sign is because they don't believe who I am. They don't know who I am. They just don't get it. And Jesus says, and boy, disciples, you better be careful. Because have the disciples been struggling with his identity as well? Yeah. The last time they were in a boat. What happened the last time they were in a boat? Hint, Jesus wasn't sleeping. What's that? Jesus walking on water, and what do they say? It's a ghost, we're going to die. And Jesus says, oh my gosh, don't you know it is I, ego eimi. And he gets in the boat, and they say, who is this? They don't get it. They don't know who he is. And he says, you got to be careful, because I'm telling you, if you want to know the thing that's going to destroy your life, disciples and students here at Ozark, you want to know what's going to destroy your faith? It's when you forget who Jesus is. When you don't know who he is. Matthew 25, the parable of the talents, that's what that parable is all about. 2 years ago at Faith Forum, we were taught, I thought inaccurately, that the parable of the talents was about using what you have to expand the kingdom as large as you can, possibly. But really the issue, the reason why the guy is judged in the parable of the talents, Matthew 25, it's not because he didn't expand his one talent really far. It's because he looks at God and he says, I knew you were an evil man who reaped where you did not sow. And God goes, oh, that's who I am. So you know me. That's the kind of God I am. Well, you know what? If that's the kind of God I am, then maybe that's the kind of God I'll be to you. He says, get out of here. Give your talent to the guy that had 10. Because the reason why his talents even expanded is not because of what he was able to do, but it's because what I was able to do through him. Because he knew me. The issue is about identity. It always is. If you want to know why your life in Jesus isn't completed, maybe it's because you don't really know who he is that well. And knowing is not just being able to recite the different monikers or titles that we can attach to Jesus. It's knowing him in a way that it actually empowers you to do things beyond yourself. That is the definition of faith. The acknowledgement and the submission to the identity and the power of Jesus. That's what we've been talking about the whole time. Jesus says, your faith has healed you. Why? Because you know who I am. He's looked at them and he's saying, you want to know why the Pharisees and the Sadducees are deaf and dumb? Because they don't get who I am. They just don't get it. And oh, the poor disciples open their mouth and dispel all mystery. They discussed this with one another and said, it's because we forgot the bread. Oh man, he's so mad. Because we only have one loaf. I mean, he could probably turn them into however many he wants, but he's so mad. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about bread? Do you still not understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and have ears but fail to hear? Don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many basketfuls of pieces of bread did you pick up? 12. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 7. And you still don't get it? Don't you know who I am? If the number 12 and the number 7 don't say anything to you, that because of me, because of who I am, the complete provision of God comes to His people. If you still don't get it, the issue has never been bread, it's never been clean and unclean, it's about who I am. And until you get this, you're going to be fighting for the side of the Pharisees and the Herod, and it seems like they're attached to Satan's side. You see the issue? Clean and unclean is not just about Gentile inclusion. It's about the identity of Jesus. And the deaf, mute disciples, in just a minute, will have another miracle that will show who they really are, or where they're really at spiritually. They have ears to hear, but they're not hearing. They have eyes to see, but they are blind. Just like the Pharisees and Herod. And what blinds them is not just honor, shame, it's not just fighting for themselves. It's that they don't know who Jesus is. And notice where we're about ready to run into. Look down in verse 27. What's the heading right there? Confession of Christ, which is all about Jesus' identity. They're going to take a stab at it, and they'll get it right, but then they get it all wrong. Make sure we're not the same. Love you guys. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning.